evening, everyone. I'm Lina Ormoudou, and welcome to Health Chat. Cancer, it is one of the most devastating diagnoses one will hear. The World Health Organization says every year about 8 million people die of cancer. It is one of the leading causes of death in the world, particularly in developing countries. 60% of new annual cases occur in Africa, Asia, Central and South America. On today's program, we will discuss cancer with our phone guest from Geneva, Switzerland, Dr. Julie Torode, Deputy CEO and Head of Programs and Global Advocacy with the Union for International Cancer Control. Dr. Torode, welcome to the program.
I'm happy to be here.
It's good to have you with us. And also joining us via phone from Geneva is Kerry Adams, CEO of the Union for International Cancer Control. Mr. Adams, welcome to Health Chat.
It's great to be here. Thank you very much for the invitation.
It's good to have the both of you join us today. And let me tell our listeners that we will be talking about cancer today with both our experts in a second. But first, let's listen to this report.
When a person develops cancer, the body mounts an immune response against the renegade cells, but it's often too weak to halt their spread. So to supplement radiation and chemotherapy treatment, scientists have been working to develop vaccines to boost the body's natural defenses against the tumors. Two promising vaccines in late-stage human trials target prostate cancer and metastatic melanoma, the deadliest form of skin cancer. Another vaccine in the pipeline is designed to treat solid tumors that form in the mucosal tissues that line passages of the head, neck, lungs, and genitals. The tissues produce a thick, lubricating fluid containing powerful chemicals that normally protect against infection. Unfortunately, they also block the immune cells that would otherwise fight the cancerous tumors. Now researchers have developed a nasal spray vaccine which overcomes this resistance, activating and mobilizing a specific type of immune cell called a CD8 T cell in the tissue at the tumor site. Eric Tatour, a researcher at the Université Paris-Descartes, led a team studying the effectiveness of the intranasal spray on solid mucosal tumors in mice. He says the tumors developed after the mice were infected with a strain of human papillomavirus that's known to cause cancer.
The tumor shrank, and we also analyzed the tumor when they shrank. And they are heavily infiltrated by immune cells, which destroy the tumors.
Tartour and colleagues also compared the effectiveness of their vaccine when it was injected and found it was less potent than when given by nasal spray.
What we demonstrated in this study is that it is important the way you administer a vaccine. It is not only to have a good cancer vaccine, it is also important to have a proper way to administer it.
Tartour says the researchers' next goal is to see how well their intranasal vaccine, which has been 5 years in development, works against tumors that have metastasized or spread to distant sites in the body. Eric Tartour and colleagues describe their anti-cancer nasal spray in an article in the journal Science Translational Medicine. That's today's Health Brief. I'm Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
So you are listening to Health Chat with our guests who are joining us from Geneva, Dr. Julie Torode and Mr. Kerry Adams, of both from the Union for International Cancer Control. Now, let me start with this question, and perhaps I can direct it to you, Dr. Torode. We hear about cancer. Everyone knows that it's really a terrible diagnosis that no one wants to hear. If we wanted to put it simply, it's perhaps a bit bold to think that, but if we want to put it simply, how can we understand what cancer is really? Because there are so many types of cancers, more than 100. How can we simply understand what cancer is?
Okay, that's quite a complicated question, but simply I would say when we grow, our cells grow, they replicate, they make themselves again. And sometimes that process goes a bit wrong, And there's different ways of that mechanism not working. And so suddenly the growth will be much more profuse. There'll be much more. And this is really what the cancer is, the growth of cells going slightly wrong and creating these masses that we can detect and cause pain in the body.
So, Mr. Adams, let me come to you and ask you about the incidence of cancer. It seems like it is growing around the world, especially in the developing world. We've seen a trend there. Can you expand on what is happening?
Well, yes. I mean, basically, you've got a larger world population multiplied by an aging population as we're able to successfully live longer because of healthy lifestyles, etc. And combine that with rapid urbanization in most parts of the world and the adoption of Western habits and diets, and I'm afraid you end up with a larger non-communicable disease problem as well as cancer within that. So, yes, there's a lot of things which are driving the numbers for cancer to grow in all parts of the world. But because of the growth in the developing countries of the population and the aging, it is more acute in those countries.
So then, do you have some statistics in terms of what some of the regions that are perhaps the most affected than others? What do you have?
Well, overall, we're looking at about 8.2 million deaths per year from 12 million cases. And in Africa specifically, you're probably looking at about 750,000 of cases every year, new cases of cancer, and approximately 500,000 people dying from that. Now, the numbers in developing countries are lower than the developed countries because of the younger population. But unfortunately, because of the health infrastructure not being there to actually treat cancer, you're looking at higher levels of cancer deaths. So it's a significant problem in Africa and many developing countries.
Now, Dr. Torode, let's talk about the types of cancer, although we don't want to go specifically on all these cancers, more than 100, of course. Let's talk about some of the most common. When you look at the developed world as opposed to the developing world, and let's specify with Africa, what can you tell us?
Well, why the numbers of the incidence of cancer are small in Africa, the burden with respect to death and yes, just the life lost, the life years lost is high and is already as high as in high income countries. And this is due to two drivers for causing cancer in Africa. One is the infectious disease route. And so we still have a high level of cancers caused by HIV infection, HPV infection that causes cervical cancer, and we also have cancers like Burkitt's lymphoma, which is very much related to the malaria belt of Africa. But of course, because of the urbanization, the growing population, the older population, we're also seeing what we call the lifestyle cancers emerging. And those are cancers that become, along with an aging population, we're seeing high levels of breast and cervical cancer. And in fact, in Africa, women's cancers are by far the most common cancers. Almost 50% of all cancer in Africa is either breast or cervical cancer. And in men, we're seeing the emergence of prostate cancer and colorectal cancers in both sexes.
That's very, very interesting there, this information. Because me being from Africa, I remember back then how people used to think that, oh, cancer is a disease of the West, we should not worry about this, we have other issues, but it is a reality today. And when you talked about infectious diseases and how some of them can lead to cancers, how do we address? We've seen the case of cervical cancer that can be prevented, but is still causing a high mortality rate among African women. What do we do to prevent this specific type of cancer?
Well, you're right. 8 of every 10 women that die of cervical cancer globally are African women, so it's very much a problem for Africa. We have great progress in this area because we do now have the Gavi Alliance, which has taken the HPV vaccine into its suite of vaccines, and this enables the vaccine to be available at much lower cost than it would be outside of that process. And what we're also finding is there are new data showing that just two doses of the vaccine are enough to protect, which means that it's easier to administer in the school year, and of course also makes it cheaper with just two vaccines rather than three. So the vaccination is an important intervention, and we need to encourage governments to see how effective that can be and encourage families with young girls to make sure that their girls do get vaccinated. And what we want to make sure is that the whole population is protected, so that we can actually eliminate this virus from the population, which is called a herd effect. And once we get that infection down, then it won't be such a problem. Okay. But of course, for older women, the vaccine is not an option. It's something that needs to be given before an HPV infection is there. So when for older women, what we need to look at is screening. And cervical cancer screening is also extremely effective. Where it's a slow developing cancer, and so we're able to find what we call early lesions, not quite aggressive cancers, and that we're able to remove those very easily with a very simple intervention, which we call visual inspection, mm-hmm. with looking at the cervix with acetic acid, and then if there is a lesion, we can treat that with cryotherapy, just a cold application to the lesion to remove it. And that's very effective. It can be done in one sitting with a screening and a treatment at the same time. And this is what we're encouraging governments to think about implementing across Africa. And there are many countries already in Africa doing a great job at building those types of programs.
Very interesting that you mentioned a couple of times how government has to play a role. And Mr. Adams, could you answer this question? How do you ensure that government gets involved? Because sometimes there seems to be a lack of political will.
Well, there's a number of ways in which governments respond to health issues they see in their countries. One of those which we're very involved with here in Geneva, working with the World Health Organization, is to encourage all countries to make some commitments themselves through a United Nations resolution that they see cancer as an essential component of their health strategy, and they wish to give global commitments to address it within their own national boundaries. So, for example, in recent years, governments have committed on the risk factors, for example, to reduce the amount of smoking by 30% by 2025. They've also given targets for alcohol use, physical activity. And importantly, they've also committed to screening programs as well as vaccination programs. So our job here is to make sure that governments around the world take a coherent view, a global problem, and then take it back to their own countries and do the second step, which is absolutely fundamental, which is to create their own national cancer control plan. And this cancer control plan will cover the full spectrum of issues from prevention, as Julie just described, through example, vaccination programs, or early detection through screening programs, treatment and care, particularly care, with palliative care being a major consideration in many low and middle-income countries. Now, those national cancer control plans will vary country to country and reflect the nature of the cancer problem in that country. And there are plenty of international organizations like my own, which would be more than happy to help countries identify the key issues and then plan forward on how we can actually address them. But I guess at the end of the day, it's got to be a combination of the government making cancer a priority and allocating health spend to it, mm-hmm. but also the communities outside of that country that can offer overseas development assistance or resources or technical support or even funding, like Gavi, as Julie mentioned. It's up to the broader community to help those countries that are struggling to find the dollars to put in place a cancer health infrastructure. It's up to us to actually help.
Now, let's talk about, you mentioned the importance of countries taking ownership of this by making a commitment. But then, to what extent are they held accountable? Is there any type of accountability that is put in, system that is put in place to ensure that they implement whatever commitment or actions or or different steps that was taken when, you know, when the countries meet and the international community meet, and then they go back to their countries. How do we hold them accountable, or can we even hold them accountable?
Well, let me talk at the high level, the global level, first of all. Then Julie will talk about how we mobilize UICC members in countries to also work with governments to hold them accountable. So the first thing is that the targets that have been agreed by countries around the world for cancer and NCDs are embedded in a resolution, and all government heads have to report back to the United Nations on a what looks like every 3 to 4 years on how they are performing against those targets. They are then reported on from the World Health Organization, so we can see who's performing well and who's performing badly. And, of course, there's a great motivation for most health ministers, indeed heads of state, when they report back to the United Nations to ensure that their country is not bottom of that list. So there is an accountability mechanism in there, which is both a formal one and an informal one, on reporting back on progress of hitting those targets for non-communicable diseases and cancer specifically. Now, I must admit that the nature of the involvement of the local cancer organizations has probably changed in the last few years from being advocates demanding attention to being organizations that actually wish to help governments fulfill those obligations. And let me just hand over to Julie, who works very closely with our members in many countries in the developing world to help them use new toolkits and to talk to the governments about how they can help implement a cancer plan.
Okay, go ahead, Dr. Torode. Please.
Yes, we've been really trying to inform our members about their role as national advocates to make sure that, you know, they don't just talk about one particular cancer issue and focus on their own topics of interest, but actually also become advisors to governments. We do need a cancer plan that's addressing systematically the building blocks that Kerry's mentioned, and we do need a cancer registry at every country to make sure that we do know that the efforts that are being implemented are in the right place. If you don't know what your cancer burden is, you're probably spending your money and time on the wrong types of activity. So those are the core things that we encourage our members to talk to member states and talk to their governments about, but also then to encourage our members to really talk about cost-effective interventions, understand the limitations that some of their environments have. But we know that investing now and in taking action now is going to save money in the future. It's going to save money for economies, and it's going to save social economy as well. And we need governments to start making those investments rather than sitting back and hoping that this cancer burden that's coming their way in Africa is not going to happen, because we know it will.
Okay, and Dr. Torode, Mr. Adams, we are so glad you're joining us today. We will take a short break, and when we come back, continue this very interesting discussion with the both of you. And to you listeners, we are grateful you're joining us. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bungani in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today, because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Welcome back to Health Chat. If you are just joining us, we are discussing cancer today and looking at the global incidence of cancer with an emphasis on Africa and how this is being addressed. Our guests, Dr. Julie Torode, she's Deputy CEO and Head of Programs and Global Advocacy with the Union for International Cancer Control, and also joining us via phone from Geneva is Kerry Adams. He is a CEO of the Union for International Cancer Control. When we talk about cancer, I think there are some people are still a bit confused. Even when you talk to them about cancer and we talk about prevention, you hear some people say, oh, no, you should not have sugar. Sugar causes cancer. Radiation causes cancer. You know, they said the treatment, the type of treatment you take can even have some side effect. All the radiation is bad. So really, there is a very kind of confused messaging, or perhaps some people are confused at least. So what can we really understand if we were to say these are the steps to prevent cancer? There are several cancers, but what are some of the basic steps to prevent cancer? Nothing is guaranteed. We can always try to prevent, although we cannot guarantee that it will not happen. But what can one do to increase his or her chances to prevent the disease?
You're absolutely right. There is a general misunderstanding around the globe, not just in Africa, with regard to what causes cancer and how fatal it is. It's quite common in the press. The press will pick up a small story somewhere, and it will become exaggerated around the world about a link between a certain vegetable or something and cancer. But let's be clear. The research that's been conducted by the leading academics in the world and scientists over many years have identified what the core causes are, or the risk factors, for most of the common cancers. And we know tobacco is a significant risk factor. We know that obesity is a risk factor. We know a lack of physical activity is a risk factor. We know that excess alcohol is a risk factor. We also know, as Julie has mentioned earlier in the show, that there are certain viruses which cause cervical cancer, colorectal cancer. There's all sorts. So we know all of that information. And if you add them all up, our colleagues at the UN agency IARC in Lyon would say that probably 50% of cancers can be prevented. So that is all available. And I guess the challenge that we have through organizations like my own, as well as governments, is to ensure that we translate that good, solid science into very clear strategies and policies within countries. So there must be a tobacco control policy. There must be vaccinations policies. There must be all sorts of things which align with the science that we know about and has been well applied around the world, which can reduce the burden of cancer in the longer term. So I think that we do, as a community, have a responsibility to express the fact to people so that they are able to make informed decisions. But that's at an individual level. But clearly, there is an obligation on governments to make sure they translate fact into specific policies which are proven to work. And Julie, maybe you can talk about tobacco, because we know that that is obviously one of the biggest issues, and there are proven ways to reduce tobacco use.
Yes, yes, indeed. Would like
yes,
to hear
and
that.
Although tobacco use is maybe not as prevalent in Africa as it is here in Europe, I think it's an important policy issue that governments across Africa really need to address. And we know for sure that increasing taxation does have an impact and does reduce smoking. And smoking is a risk factor for many, many cancers, a big driver of cancer overall. The same with alcohol. It's maybe not as a prevalent social activity across Africa, but you need to get these policies in place early so that you're not struggling with the issues that we are struggling with here, and we are seeing that many cancers are driven by alcohol as well. And as we become more urbanized, sitting in cars and sitting in our desks at work instead of being physically active, that's a big driver for cancer. So there's many things you can do as an individual to think about reducing your risk, not smoking, only drinking one or two glasses of wine or beer a week, trying to be physically active at least three times a week, trying to keep a healthy weight, trying to have a mixed diet with the fruit and vegetables as well as meats, to really try and reduce your own personal risk. And the other thing you can do is really get to know about the cancers that you can find early, understand the signs and symptoms, so that if you do think you've got a symptom that could be cancer, that you go and find help. Because if you find a cancer early, there's a lot more that a doctor can do to help treat that cancer and hopefully cure that cancer. Okay. So I think we do really, and particularly in the areas of breast and cervical cancer, those are ones that we can't necessarily control. You know, breast cancer is largely due to the fact that we as women are exposed to hormones. That's normal, a normal case for a woman that she's exposed to hormones. And these are a big driver of breast cancer. So you can't necessarily control that, but you can learn about how to examine your breasts, understand what is normal for your breast, so that if you do think there's a lump, you can go and find a doctor and make and check to see if that is something that you should be concerned about. And a breast lump can be removed by surgery, can be treated very simply, but a breast cancer that is spread to the rest of the body is very difficult to treat. So I would encourage people to think about reducing their risks, but also learn about signs and symptoms, find out where they can go for screening, so that they can really find cancer early and make the best of an early diagnosis.
Let me ask you a follow-up question about the breast cancer specifically, because this is obviously one that is very, very common among women, regardless of where they are.
Yes.
You talked about the lump. If a woman finds a lump, she should report. But is it possible that a breast cancer can develop without a lump being a sign of cancer? I mean, can a woman have breast cancer without having a lump? Is it possible?
It's possible, but very unusual.
Okay.
So the normal signs would be a lump. Or what we call the sort of orange skin type, where your skin looks a bit like an orange or is pulled in,
mm-hmm.
or if there is some fluid coming out of the nipple.
Okay.
So any of those could be signs of a problem, and you should go and find a specialist that can ease those concerns.
Okay.
I would also say that there are often lumps that are not cancer. So just because you find something that feels like a lump, still go and find help, because it might be a cyst which isn't cancer, and therefore you can also stop worrying about it. So yes, there are lumps. Not all lumps are cancer. But if you find something, please go and find someone that can help ease your concerns.
Now, what is one of the first thing, if not the first thing, that one should ask the doctor when they receive the diagnosis of cancer? Because this is a diagnosis that really can leave people in a state of panic.
I think the first thing I would say is it's normal to panic, and it's normal to be confused. So I would suggest that don't worry about bothering your doctor. That's what your doctor is there for. So if you have questions, even if you have them afterwards, write them down and ask them next time you go and see your doctor. What you should really know, of course, is what cancer is it? What are the next steps to decide on your treatment? And if there is anything that the doctor recommends that you can do to help support the best outcome for your treatment.
Okay.
You mentioned side effects before. Some things can be done to reduce the impact of side effects and make yourself manage the treatment better, and a doctor can help you with that.
Okay.
But really, you do need to know what is the cancer. Also, what stage is the cancer is also a good question to ask, because that helps you understand your treatment. And I would also say ask your doctor about organizations that can help you understand the cancer more. There's a lot of cancer societies now emerging in Africa, and they also provide information to patients, helping them understand the diagnosis, understand the treatment, and be able to think about questions you might want to ask next time you go to the doctor.
Okay, and on this note, Mr. Adams, let me thank you for joining us today for this discussion.
Thank you very much. It's been most enjoyable.
And Dr. Julie Turede, thank you so much again for your insight on the topic.
Thank you very much.
For more on today's program or other programs, you can log on to our website at voanews.com/VOA Africa Health Chat. Thank you for all for joining us, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Linor Mudu in Washington, with producer Jackson Bungani. Until next time, take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy day.